Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Adventures in DevOps. This week on our panel, we have Caleb Fornari.
Hey, everyone.
Jeffrey Groman.
Hey there.
I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. Just going to do a quick shout out. We're starting to get premium versions of the podcast out. Right now, it's just without the ads, but I'm looking to add some other stuff to it. So stay tuned for that. We have a special guest this week, and that is Will Button. Will, do you want to say hello and tell us who you are and why you're famous?
Right on. Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on the show. I'm Will Button, been doing DevOps for quite a while now, and I spend a lot of that time and energy working with early stage tech startups, helping them go from, you know, getting those, once they have their first 10,000 customers, getting up to over a million or so, which has been, you know, it's pretty entertaining to say the least.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Now I want to pick your brain about that.
But, right on.
When I went freelance, I was still only a few years into my development career. My first contract, I was paid $60 an hour. Due to feedback from my friends, I raised it to $120 an hour on the next contract. And due to the podcasts I was involved in and the screencasts I had made in the past, I started getting calls from people I'd never even heard of who wanted me to do development work for them because I had done that kind of work or talked about or demonstrated that kind of work in the videos and podcasts that I was making. Within a year, I was able to more than double my freelancing rates, and I had more work than I could handle. If you're thinking about freelancing or have a profitable but not busy or fulfilling freelance practice, let me show you how to do it in my Dev Heroes Accelerator. Dev Heroes aren't just people who devs admire. They're also people who deliver for clients who know, like, and trust them. Let me help you double your income and fill your slowdowns. You can learn more at devheroesaccelerator.com. Yeah, but let's go ahead and kind of introduce our topic here. What I have you down for is DevOps for developers. And there's some other stuff here, but yeah, we've talked a bit about development and like development practices and things like that. And then we've kind of talked about some of the ethos, I guess, of the DevOps movement. But I'm curious, you know, what's different in your take about DevOps for developers as opposed to like DevOps for ops people or DevOps for people who have been doing DevOps for a while?
You know, I think the main thing that I'm trying to enforce with that is that DevOps really is, if you are doing DevOps, you are a software engineer. And like where that really becomes relevant is there's a significant shortage of DevOps people for the different positions that are open. And so I want to encourage people who are doing software development or who are just getting started in their career that want to do software engineering, that DevOps is a valid software engineering path. And it's actually really rewarding, really entertaining. And it's also something where there's like a lot of overlap between software engineering. And I think that's part of like why you get into that conversation of DevOps being about culture and DevOps having the ethos and different things like that. And that it's not a position that as a DevOps engineer, you can go in and you can do it by yourself. You've got to have buy-in, support, and cooperation from the software engineers and the IT teams that you work with to be successful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm wondering how that lines up with our other panelists' experience.
Yeah, I would say that's spot on from my experience, maybe similar to Will. I've done a lot of scaling startups from zero to a million or, you know, those types of things. And yeah, DevOps is one of those things where it's a little hard to define sometimes. The skill set is kind of broad and there's a lot of confusion around what exactly it is, what exactly it is not, and what skills are kind of required in order to really be a DevOps engineer or what's involved in the day-to-day role of being one. So I would just corroborate all of that really. It's definitely lined up with my experience.
Yeah, I guess that the nuance I guess I would add is just having worked with so many sort of larger companies, larger enterprises, right? So who got started in the legacy world, whether it was with mainframes or, you know, even if not, right? But who have a ton of applications, a ton of what we call technical debt, right? We talk about that all the time. And, you know, just culturally, it's a huge shift. That's just what I see. I just see the struggles where they try to take on having more of an agile mindset. And I think along the road that has sort of brought in at least the notion of DevOps. And sometimes it's more than just that. And sometimes it's, no, we'll just call the engineering people DevOps, but they're separate from the applications people and they don't talk to each other. But we'll call them DevOps engineers because it looks cool when we try to hire and we get better resumes that way or something. But I just, you know, overall, like I think we could dig deeper into this, but I just see so much of a more of a struggle with, you know, in the enterprise space. And that's not to say, I mean, I have seen it also on smaller startups, but it's like, you're surprised when you don't see it. When you see things really working well in the enterprise space, you're almost surprised by it because it's, I feel like that's, yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm not trying to pick on them or anything. I just feel like it's a bigger, they have a bigger set of hurdles to get past. That's just what I've seen. And my take, I would say, you know, my take is always from the security standpoint, that's where I live. But in the security world, we're even more like siloed off from everybody else. But I'm always sort of looking into them and saying, yeah, they're not that much better off than I am. They're pretty siloed too.
It's interesting too, just to kind of pile on here, because some of the DevOps stuff I've seen, yeah, they essentially just create a silo, right? It doesn't pull from dev. It doesn't pull from whatever legacy operational side they've had. And I've worked on both, right? My job in college, I worked in a data center, and then I moved into server management, systems administration, and network administration. And then I got into dev and, you know, came at it from a completely different direction. And what I see is that a lot of times companies will, yeah, they'll just grab DevOps and they'll use it as a stand-in for kind of the traditional systems admin and things like that, right? And so they just, they want some of the nice things they see there, but they're not really willing to let them integrate up the chain or down the chain. It's kind of the shift left that we talk about here, right? They don't want that. They just want them to do their piece and have that be it. But then I've also seen it where companies are small and they're kind of scrappy. And so DevOps is an outgrowth of development, right? And so they're basically part of the team. And half the time they're writing app code and the other half of the time they're deploying it. And so anyway, it's really interesting to kind of see where that goes. And I'm a little curious as we get into this, right? Because we can have that overlap. Is there a happy medium one way or the other? Like, is there too much siloing or, you know, too much integration one way or the other?
I don't know that there can really be too much. I suppose, yeah, if you lose the responsibility of who owns what, then it can get to be a really gray area and no one knows what they're actually accountable for. The way I've approached it with the startups I've worked with is, you know, you have like your person who has the assigned DevOps role, but they actually live with a particular engineering team. And so they'll be part of their scrums, part of their sprints, and taking on the communication role of understanding what the needs of that particular team are. And then at the same time, they're still part of the overall DevOps or IT team, which is a lot of overlap in the startups that I work with. And so then you have the communication there so that it's almost like you're a messenger at that point. So you go sit in the enemy's camp, for lack of a better term, to find out what they're up to and what they need help with. And then you go back to your core team, your DevOps or your IT team, and you see what everyone else is up to, what everyone else is bringing back. And that helps you understand what the infrastructure needs to look like going forward and kind of a rough guideline of what the timeline that it needs to be implemented in.
You mentioned ownership there. I'm curious, in the, you know, environments you've worked in, do you normally have developers owning kind of the responsibility for the applications, their deployment, those kind of things? And then DevOps is more of a bridge to the more infrastructure and cloud, you know, type technologies that underlie the applications? Or does the responsibility for deployment ultimately lie on the DevOps engineers or engineer if it's someone embedded in a team of developers? How does that usually look for you, the distribution of responsibility? And what are your thoughts on maybe the ideal way to structure that?
I set it up so that the development teams own their own deployment process. So the deployment, the configuration, what the runtime configuration and runtime infrastructure looks like is actually defined inside of the same repo that they're writing application code in. So they have control over how much memory they get allocated, what kind of CPU resources they have allocated, the load balancer, whether it's internal or external, different things like that. And then the DevOps role is to really understand what it is they're trying to build and make sure that they have a way to get that deployed in an automated fashion. So building out the CI/CD pipeline, building out the correct, I work in AWS a lot, so building out the correct security groups or VPCs in AWS so that they have a secure place to deploy into, and then providing the infrastructure so that whenever the deployment happens, that the monitoring and the logging and the alerting, all of that's bundled in with it and just happens as part of the deployment process. And it's automated so that it doesn't get forgotten, overlooked, or different things like that. But so the deployment process itself is the responsibility of the development team. The infrastructure that powers it is kind of where DevOps comes in.
That's interesting. So that's kind of where, how do I put it? So all of the stuff that you're talking about, where you give that responsibility to developers. In my current full-time job, and I've been a little bit cagey about where I'm actually working these days, but in my current development job, we don't control any of the infrastructure at all, right? And we can do some of the Docker setup, right? But I mean, they deploy it, they give it the resources, they tell it how much it gets and all that stuff. We can update the Docker containers and the environment that way, but that's about it. And I don't know if that's the level you're talking about or not, as far as what the developers control. But I've also worked in a place where it was running on servers where the DevOps team actually controlled it all, down to the point where if we wanted to deploy a new library into our web app, we actually had to go through them to get them to vet it. Now, we were dealing with government data, and there were some other concerns there with security and things like that, but they actually had to go in and double check that the dependencies that we were pulling in were, you know, properly looked at. And then they would actually package it up as an RPM package and deploy it to the machine independent of the repositories that usually have the packages. And so I'm just wondering, the one that I'm working in now is definitely more pleasant to work in than the other, right? Because it's a giant pain to go through that process every time you make a change, and then to go beg them to deploy it every time it's time to deploy. I'm just wondering, you know, how do you handle some of that, right? Because they were completely siloed from us, where in this case, where I'm working now, they're on a separate team, but we talk all the time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I provide like a base Docker image, because with most of the companies, you know, there's like these core things that you have to have that are common across any application that you're deploying. You know, if you're in a microservices type environment, there'll be common things common to all of those. So we'll bundle all of that up into a base Docker image. And so then each individual development team, when building their own application, they'll start with that Docker image and then add whatever packages or customizations, ports, different things like that need to be opened up. They'll add to that Docker image. And so we can do security updates at the OS level by updating that base Docker image. And then whenever they do their next deploy, they'll automatically get those updates in there. As far as like individual application security concerns, like if they use an NPM package or, you know, something from PyPI, they own the updates and the security updates around that as part of their software development process.
I've seen this go both ways, where it really depends on, I guess, your security threat model, and also sometimes the size of the company, the size of the teams involved. If you've got explicit IT teams and then you have development teams, and DevOps is kind of trying to bridge the gap between those two, that looks a little different than if you have an embedded DevOps person in a development team. If you're fully cloud native, then that of course makes a difference as far as self-service for developers. It's a little bit easier to, you know, just kind of give them the framework for spinning things up and let them kind of define resources for applications. and those kind of things. I don't think there's any one approach here. I think maybe that's something that gets missed or doesn't get emphasized enough in the DevOps world. It really does depend on your security threat model, what you're deploying, your company culture. I mean, there's so many moving parts that it's part of what makes DevOps exciting, I think, is the amount of different things that you can be involved in and the fact that you can actually try to influence culture and those kind of things along with the technical side of it. One of the things that I've written about in the past is if you're a DevOps engineer on a team, maybe that doesn't really have a DevOps culture yet, or maybe you have management that's not exactly cooperative, or you're stuck in an environment that's a little bit more restrictive, maybe, how you can kind of try to affect change from the bottom up. Will, I'm curious if that's something you've thought about, like, how do you deal with, as a DevOps engineer, you know, maybe uncooperative management? Is there a way you can do that productively, or, you know, deal with maybe security constraints or other things that are imposed on you from the outside?
Yeah, I think it's really, that really ties into like one of the core skills that a DevOps engineer needs to be successful, and that's communication. Because anytime you have resistance, whether it's from someone up your chain of command or with your peers, it's almost always there's a misunderstanding there. Because if you're trying to do something that's good and helpful and the intent is to solve a problem and someone's pushing back against that, then there's a communication gap there. Either you don't understand the problem, or the way that you understand it is not correct, or you haven't relayed to them what you're trying to do in a way that they understand it. And so you have to go and have that communication to figure out where the delta is there. And I actually, there's a book, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, he was a former FBI hostage negotiator, but the book is really, really cool and really helpful in communication, because he goes through this system of working through communication gaps, you know, based on his experience in negotiating for hostages. But it translates really well into DevOps, IT, and just any business communication in itself, to understand where that communication barrier is and what the unknown is, and then drill down on that to find why you're not communicating and reach common ground with whoever it is you're talking to.
One thing, and I totally agree with you, Will, is that, you know, communication, I think it's just so crucial no matter how the organization is set up. I don't think it really, it doesn't matter what the org chart looks like if everyone's communicating together. And I, you know, just to go back to something that Caleb said, I think is right on, is that when you think about, this is my experience and from the security standpoint, is that, and I think this just ties in directly, is that when there are silos and there's not communication, there's not good communication, not active communication going on, that's where security just suffers, because the security folks have no idea what's going on in the application, have no idea what the infrastructure looks like, just don't get it. And if you don't, from my perspective, if I'm the security guy and I have no idea what's going on, I have no idea what the exposure looks like. I don't know what the threats are. I can't apply what I know about security to the environment because I don't understand the environment. Just case in point, you know, recently the whole CodeCov breach. I don't know if you guys were sort of watching that. I find it really interesting. But so here you've got something that's, I don't know, what do you want to call it, supply chain or you know, SaaS provider, right, who gets breached. And so if you're using them, in your application, from a security standpoint, if I have no idea how the application folks are using that for automated testing, right, of their code, and I don't know where the tie-ins are to all the other pieces, then I have no idea what we're exposed to. You know, it's only if I understand how the entire ecosystem ties together that I can step in and say, hey guys, this is a real problem based on how we're using these guys and how they're breached, and basically all of our secrets, all these APIs across the ecosystem have now, we have to consider them breached as well, and et cetera, et cetera. But if I don't know that, I can't do it. And so to me, it's like, it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether you're doing DevOps or whether you're doing, you know, old school waterfall and all that. If you guys aren't communicating, you got big problems across the board.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've seen common to that, especially as organizations get larger, is the illusion that we are communicating. You know, like you from a security perspective, you're like, man, I've got no visibility into this. But when you go and talk to the development teams themselves, they're like, yeah, we're putting it into a Slack channel or something. Then you're like, I had no idea that Slack channel even existed, or we don't use Slack at all, you know, different things like that, which comes back down to the communication thing where someone thinks they're communicating, but they're actually only sending messages now out and not verifying that the message was received.
Yeah, no, I think that's so true. Like, hey, yeah, you weren't paying attention in Slack, or you didn't see the wiki update or whatever. And it's just like, you sent out the SIN, but you didn't get the ACK. You got to realize that that's, you know, I think that's so true. And we absolutely see that.
So I kind of want to bring this back around to the whole idea of DevOps for developers, because at some level, we're talking about taking responsibility for certain parts of the pipeline. And at some level, we're talking about understanding the other people who take care of other parts of the pipeline. So when we're talking about DevOps for developers, are we focused more on taking on more responsibility across the pipeline, or are we focused on just focusing on the parts that we control and then understanding enough about the rest of the pipeline and what everybody else is doing to be able to effectively communicate with them?
For me, I think it's just taking on the parts that relate to your application specifically, the parts that you need to get your business done, but having an understanding of what that looks like in the bigger ecosystem to understand, like, what are the dependencies there? What are the capabilities there? What things can we do? And then as a developer, what problems am I facing that I could leverage some of this stuff that already exists to make that problem go away? Rather than having this problem, not knowing anything about the infrastructure and going and dragging in another dependency to fix that problem when we had something in place that would already have remedied that. I've been actually in the early days of AWS, you know, that was one of the key ways that AWS got a foothold into an organization, because developers had difficulty in deploying the software and it was an arduous process. And so then AWS comes along and all they need is their manager's credit card number and they could deploy it themselves. So again, back to the communication thing, you know, rather than communicating with the IT team to figure out what was wrong with the deployment model, they drug in this AWS thing and just started running it there. And then 6-12 months later, IT figures out that they're running in AWS and every developer has the root credentials and the root SSH keys, and then they've got to try to reverse engineer this thing to bring it back into the data center or figure out how to corral AWS into their existing IT infrastructure.
I've seen that in a number of engagements where clients have brought me in as a freelancer in the past and things like that, almost as a stealth consultant to help them get something onto AWS because their own internal IT was so slow. And one of the things that, you know, coming back to kind of communication and maybe the skills around DevOps, one of the things that I kind of have to slowly steer them toward is like, hey, we can get this deployed, we can solve your problems, but we need to think about how we bring this back to your IT organization and get you guys communicating better so that they're not the bottleneck, you're not the bottleneck, and you guys are actually talking together and figuring this out collaboratively, right? So that's one of the really, I think, key skills in DevOps is that ability to kind of move things forward and help people accomplish their goals, but also make sure that long-term you're moving in the right direction as far as communication and organizational level goals, in addition to like team specific goals and, you know, smaller things like deploying a specific application.
Jeffrey, you were trying to say something.
No, I was just interjecting shadow IT. That's what we always called it. I don't know if you guys have that term, but we used to call that. We used to see it all the time in security. We see it less and less because now it's like the end thing that everyone's going to the cloud. So you don't really see it. But yeah, you basically just did the end around your IT folks because they were the bottleneck and you just stood stuff up. And either you did in the old days, we used to just do it. We'd see people doing it under their desks. I mean, it was literally in the shadows, mm-hmm. right? But then, you know, AWS comes around and exactly, just, you know, grab the credit card or just get reimbursed or whatever. And all of a sudden shadow IT just moves to the cloud. But then the problem was that grew to be bigger than anybody imagined. And all of a sudden, you know, the developers, whoever stood that up is now on the hook to manage it, maintain it, because the IT folks don't even know about it, right? And that's when you had to sort of get pulled back in. The IT folks like, what do you mean I have to try and help you manage this? I don't even know what this is. Like, what have you guys been doing for the last 6 months? But they, you know, that's where it all sort of comes to a head is where I, you know, it has to get the handshake has to happen and IT takes it back. And, you know, and I think we still see that today. I mean, it's really interesting to me when I look at AWS and how they've set up what they call AWS organizations, right? So that, you know, you can manage your billing and your organization. Like you can set up and say, okay, yeah, if you want to do something, you have to do it within, you know, your, so we can manage you and we can see what's going on. And we don't get these huge billing balloons and that come in, you know, these huge bills that come in. So anyway, it's interesting to see just that cultural aspect of it and how, I mean, it just shows how broken things can really be.
Now I'm going to go cowboy something up. And when IT comes to me and goes, what the heck, man? I'll be like, I'm Batman. Anyway, but it's really true. I mean, I've seen this too, right? Where, yeah, things weren't moving fast enough. We needed to get something done. I said, I've done this, right? And yeah, I mean, it's reality, right? And what's funny is that a lot of developers that I know are this way, where it's not just, hey, I wrote the code, right? Which is fun on its own, right? But it's, I want to see it out there. I want to see people use it. I want to see people benefit from it. And if IT isn't moving fast enough or ops isn't moving fast enough, then there really is this pressure on our end to go, okay, let's do this. One example of this, we had a bunch of features that we had put together for the projects we work on. And there was a deployment issue with the setup so that QA could go and approve it so it could move up the chain. And yeah, it had been driving us nuts for weeks, right? Until it finally got resolved. And it was because we wanted to see it out there. We wanted to see it move along. And so, yeah, there's definitely pressure on all ends in order to make it work. And it's not just out of we don't make money if we don't get new features out. It's literally, hey, look, I put the work in on this. Yeah, I got paid for it. But at the end of the day, I want to see it out there in the world and doing good.
Yeah, you want to see your creation go live. But you hinted at something there too. There's a lot of pressure outside of the software dev teams as well, because in a lot of these circumstances, there are sales commitments and marketing campaigns and all this business pressure that they were told on this date, this thing's going to be done. And now you're having to go back and tell them, oh, well, it's not this date. And so they're putting pressure on you. And having spent a number of years in IT, that pressure rarely makes it over to IT. You know, the software team's getting beat up because they missed the deadline, but IT, they're just like, oh, they got this thing they want to deploy. Okay, we'll get to it.
Have you ever wondered if you could be offering a faster, less buggy experience for your customers? I mean, let's face it, the only way you're going to know that is by actually running it on production. So go figure it out, right? You run it on production, but you need something plugged in so that you can find out where those issues are, where it's slowing down, where it's having bugs. You need something like that there. And Raygun is awesome at this. They just added the performance monitoring, which is really slick, and it works like a breeze. I love it. It's like you get the ray gun and you zap the bugs. Anyway, definitely go check it out. It's going to save you a ton of time, a ton of money, a ton of sanity. I mean, let's face it, grepping through logs is no fun, and having people not able to tell you that it's too slow because they got sidetracked into Twitter is also not fun. So go check out Raygun. They are definitely going to help you out. There are thousands of customer-centric, customer-focused software companies who use Raygun every day to deliver great experiences for their customers. And if you go to Raygun and you use our link, you can get a 14-day free trial. So you can go check that out at adventuresindevopspodcast.com/Raygun.
Well, again, but that's part of the communication and visibility. Right.
Exactly.
And so for us, since we were pushing up the chain, upward toward our DevOps team, and the DevOps team was working with one of the architects and some of these other folks, right, it got solved and the pressure was applied at the proper place. And so I think that's important. One thing that I'm wondering too, I need to check our time here real quick and make sure we're not going too far over. But oh, we're good. One thing that I was wondering is besides sort of the classical ways, I guess, of communicating where it's like Slack or we use Microsoft Teams, but Microsoft Teams or, you know, whatever you're using, Discord, I've seen all kinds of stuff. And maybe you have some project management software like Jira or something else. I'm telling you, these are the systems we're using where I work. I don't love them, but
you got to stop mincing words. You got to tell us how you really feel about this stuff.
Yeah, well, I don't have a convenient place to throw up, so I'm just going to make the gag noise. Anyway, so you kind of have those systems, but are there other ways of gaining that visibility and increasing the communication so that these things are sort of brought to the front before somebody really has a problem, or brought to the front as just part of a system instead of somebody going, oh, this is bad and it's been bad for a while?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's most effective for that is going to where getting information after the fact just rarely works out well. So you have to just keep moving yourself closer and closer to the source of the communication, which seems to be when you're talking with development teams, you know, when they're doing their planning meetings mm-hmm. or their weekly scrum meetings. I've invited myself to, I don't know, probably thousands of those over the years, because I go in there and I hear things and I learn things that I'm going to need to know later. And so I get that information earlier. And especially, you know, one of the things I think that's relevant now with so many people working remote is whenever you do get into a conversation with someone as the remote person, you have to understand that probably 90% of that conversation and possibly the decision about that conversation as well have already taken place before you even knew that there was a conversation happening. So you got to key in on things that aren't being said, like a reference to some known fact, or if it's a video conference when someone is speaking, look at the faces of the other participants to see what their reaction is, to see if they're really on board with this or if they have something that could be added to it, and kind of reading between the lines there. And the earlier you can get engaged in those conversations, the more time you'll have to prepare for it, and also the more success you'll have at influencing the outcome that you would like to see as well. And then after the fact, I'm a big fan of just automated messaging, just from like whenever deploys happen, making sure that the notification that a deploy just went to production is automated and goes to whatever the agreed upon channel is for that, whether it's Slack or email or mm-hmm. updating a file in the repo or something like that. Same thing with alerts, making sure that not only are the alerts going out to the right people, but inside of the alert itself is a link back to some kind of documentation so that whoever is on call responding to this knows where to go find the documentation that could have troubleshooting notes in it or architecture diagrams or just a what is this paragraph to give them a heads up on troubleshooting it.
I'm curious how you all have implemented this. I mean, feel free to name tools or systems, ideas, dashboard systems. I mean, any of that stuff, right?
Yeah, I think one of the key things Will mentioned there was agreement, which I bring up because I think it's actually more important than the specific tools that you're using, right? If it's all in Slack, that's great. That's a common one that I see quite often. Some people prefer to have everything in Jira, much as we all hate it. Get notifications kind of based on different, you know, tickets or events or things like that. Some people go with, you know, simpler things. Some people love email, right? I think the important thing is that you, as a team, collaboratively figure out what works for everybody and then stick with that convention versus like the specific sort of tools. Right now, the default choice does seem to be Slack, at least in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll steer people, like, sometimes whenever you introduce a concept like this, they'll want to say, oh, we can put this board in Jira to document it or whatever. And I try to steer them back to where they're already having conversations at that. You know, so Slack a lot of times, email and Slack for the most part are the two. And both of those have ways that you can inject messages into those platforms from a CI/CD server or from a monitoring system, just making an API call.
Yeah, I think just to add my two cents, I think the biggest issue I see is when there's just multiple channels that people are supposed to or expected to be looking at. And when that happens, stuff just falls through the cracks. Like if I have to be looking at ServiceNow tickets in two different Slack channels and my email, and people are, I don't know, chatting over Teams and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's just like, come on, folks. Like, and then everyone's got their personal stuff too, because they're still checking Facebook and Twitter and everything else. So it's just like, you know, you got 10 different channels that people are looking at on a daily basis. So yeah, minimize them. Just use something that works and keep everybody, you know, looking at the same stuff.
Yeah, not only minimize the communication channels, but minimize the messages as well, or you'll just be training everyone to ignore all messages from this particular channel or bot or whatever is sending the messages.
Yeah, that's one issue, just to kind of highlight that. So I work for a large enterprise company, and there's a lot of email that comes through, and it's all corporate, it's all automated. And it all gets archived, and I have missed stuff because I'm just sitting there going, archive, 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 archive. Because I'm going through it for the handful of things that I actually need to pay attention to. And yeah, I've missed stuff because I give it a cursory glance, and then I miss that. Oh, no, this one was important.
I'm curious, Will, since we're talking DevOps for developers, we talked about responsibilities, I think, at the beginning of this conversation, but I think the responsibilities go both ways. There's responsibilities for the DevOps engineer, and those varies based on teams. But I think developers also have some responsibilities, and maybe have a feeling these days that they're expected to know too much. They're expected to know AWS, and they're expected to know Docker, and they're expected to know Kubernetes and all these different tool sets and things like that. What are some ways or some skills that developers can and should learn? And maybe what are the things that they should think about delegating to DevOps or working with DevOps on? And how do you think about that kind of separation of skill sets? Because I think you mentioned earlier as well that, you know, you really think of a DevOps person as a software developer at their core, but they're just, you know, they have a different set of responsibilities maybe than someone developing an application directly.
Yeah, I think it'll be really helpful for developers to understand just basic operation of Docker, you know, how to create a Docker file, how to run a Docker container locally, just to get an idea for what it looks like for a Docker container to run, and then how to get that through the CI/CD pipeline. You know, what does your CI/CD pipeline look like? You know, if you're using Jenkins, for example, what does a Jenkins job look like, and what are the components that it's doing? I wouldn't expect them to know how to set up and configure Jenkins. Even building a pipeline from scratch is probably, I would say, outside the scope of your everyday developer, because the way I try to do it is I try to set up reusable pipelines. So if we're using Jenkins, I'll build a generic pipeline that you're able to use a config file to teach it to deploy any project that we, or any application that we have for that company. And so understanding how the pipeline works from a conceptual level will help you make better decisions as a developer. And then, you know, what does your runtime architecture look like? Are you using ECS Fargate in AWS, or do you run on EC2 instances? And just learn the things that are relevant to you for your application and your environment, and then block out the rest. And I think that's a really important concept, because every single day, you know, someone's got a new framework or a new tool to manage a framework, or a tool to manage the tool that manages a framework. And if you try to absorb all of that, you'll just go into information overload and want to go back to your job at the McDonald's drive-thru or something. And so just focus on the things that are relevant to you. And then as you come across new stuff, spend, you know, 15 minutes to an hour, if it's something that looks interesting to you, doing like the hello world version of that. And if it's something that looks like it's interesting to you, pursue it further. If not, just forget that it ever existed. And then if it ever comes back at some point in the future in your career, you can learn it then.
Would you summarize that as kind of focusing on the concepts over the specifics as far as tools and those kind of things go? Because that's been my experience, is that, like you said, so many different things are coming out all the time. I've been doing DevOps or related things for, you know, 15 years now, and it's impossible to keep up with everything. So even as someone with that much experience, I try to focus on, you know, okay, what are the core concepts here that enable me to kind of learn these tools or use these things as we go along? And how do I focus on understanding the holistic picture versus just this tool or that tool, and focusing on kind of the details when those can kind of be learned as you go if you need to.
Yeah, totally agree. If you understand like the concepts, then you can figure out the implementation when you need to.
Yeah, I think just one thing I'd add is if it were me, I'd want to know and this is what I tell like those types of folks as well, from the industry security standpoint, it's helpful for us from the security standpoint if developers and other folks just understand what their ecosystem looks like. You don't have to be an expert in all the components of it, but if you're using Docker or, if you're using Kubernetes or whatever it is, know at least some about that. You don't have to be the expert, but know the concepts and understand what features it's being used in your environment, in your code, and don't ignore it and say, nope, not my problem. I mean, that's what I feel like is the other side of it, is too many folks get a little bit overwhelmed. And I should say the security folks too. Like, I think from the security folks, they also have to sort of have that same mindset of, I can't be an expert in all these. I'm not going to be the developer. I'm not even going to be the DevOps person. But if we're deploying applications and code using these technologies, then I got to understand AWS and I got to understand the features in AWS we're using. And I got to understand what types of containers we're doing. And if we're writing code in Java or whatever, I have to at least understand what that means and what the types of frameworks we're using and how I have to approach application security because of those design decisions. So don't be an expert, but at least understand what's going on and have some concept of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's gotten easier in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, is saying, I don't know. Because it felt like early on in my career, saying I don't know was an unacceptable admission of failure. But now,
career killer.
Yeah, now it's okay. It's acceptable. It's okay to not know everything.
Yeah, when I was a team lead and a manager, I would always actually press people to the edge of their knowledge and make sure I got at least one or two I don't knows, because I don't need the guy that goes in and thinks he knows everything or thinks he has to know everything and won't ask for help, because that's where you have problems. Instead, you want the person that, even if it's within the realm of or their scope of responsibility, you want the person who's going to go, you know what, I'm not sure on this, right? And so I'm going to go get help. It may be internal, maybe external. It may be go take a course. It may be go talk to another expert, whatever, but get it done right.
Copy paste from Stack Overflow.
I have never, ever done that in my life, ever, ever.
I'm waiting for the Chrome extension.
I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Probably.
Yeah. So we're kind of getting toward the end of our time. I'm just wondering if there are other big ideas or big parts of this idea that we need to jump on and cover before we start heading into the close of the show.
One thing I think is worth highlighting is something Will mentioned earlier around templatizing things. That's something that I always look at. And you use the example of a Jenkins pipeline, but there are tons of tools out there. Terraform is another one that kind of does this for cloud via modules and things like that for cloud automation. And there's lots of other ones. Most CI pipeline type tools have some templating or modularization type functionality. I just thought that was worth highlighting as something that's really crucial when you're using any tool. If you want to help developers as a DevOps person, one of the biggest things you can do is try to help define these, sort of reusable things that should be the same every time that they don't really need to worry about. And then also give them the flexibility to change the things they need to change in a repeatable, reliable fashion. So, templating is one way to do that. I thought that was a really good, example you used with Jenkins and pipelines and templatizing those. But I thought it was worth just highlighting that.
I think that's a realm where the developers feel at home too, because that's something they do all the time. They'll abstract code away into a higher order component, or bring in a library that they can override. And so when you show them that concept, say, hey, you don't have to know everything about the infrastructure, just call this piece and pass it the parameters that you want it to have. That clicks with them. And then they'll just take it and run with it and do things that I would have never thought of doing with it initially.
Yeah. One thing I'm going to throw in here too, though, is that as I've been involved in the business of podcasting and things like that, this is something that we see in business too, right? So business processes follow a lot of this, and having a step-by-step guide for somebody to do some of the manual stuff or having a script or some kind of automation. I mean, heck, there's Zapier and I can't remember the other big competitor in that space, but where it's, hey, do this on Google Docs and then go do this on Google Calendar and then go do this in this other system that we use. And it's a pipeline. I've been using Monday.com lately and it's the same thing, right? It's okay, go create the tasks for this. Go keep track of this. Send an email like this. And all of it ties in. All of it boils down to a lot of the same ideas. And so, yeah, I mean, this is not just a DevOps thing, right? It's kind of an everybody everywhere thing.
Yeah, and there's a large part of DevOps, I think, that also is process related, right? So, you know, it's not just the tech, it's not just the templatizing things, but you can also work on process and try to make your processes more efficient. And part of communication is process, having a process for communication. And maybe that's something you have some insight on, Will, is do you have any sort of communication models or methods or processes that you find tend to work really well, or have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, I think that's probably the other big takeaway from this that could be useful is that there is no best practice for communication. It's so unique to the team. Every place I've gone has had a different style of communication. Some they do messages in a chat room. Some do one-on-one messages. Some do email. Some people get up and go over and walk to and talk to other people. And so I think that's the key is before trying to implement anything is find out how that team communicates. What's their preferred method for communicating? And then get involved with that and understand how that works and become integrated with that and then build on that framework, and you'll be a lot more successful rather than trying to introduce something that is not native to that group.
But how do you do that, right? Because I mean, some of it's obvious, right? Hey, everybody's on Slack, but some of it is less so as far as like, hey, how do we structure messages about this? Or how do we talk about these problems? How do we talk about these issues? How do we make sure that the information that matters is getting put in without a whole bunch of noise? How do you manage that and start to get your hands around that? Because it's, at least in my experience, is not just a natural thing that's going to fall out of your team communication. It actually takes some work to figure that stuff out.
Yeah, it's a lot of trial and error. You start, if they say, hey, we're all in Slack, then you go into Slack and you start engaging in conversations there and you work your way back to something that doesn't appear to be clear, something that's confusing, and then drill down on that and say, oh yeah, we were talking about that over in this email thread or whatever, and just try to peel back the layers until you have a better understanding of it. And it'll probably take a long time before you uncover all of those different nuances. But at least knowing that they exist gives you a head start that puts you in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, you mentioned earlier, Will, that you've invited yourself to a lot of team standups. I've done the same thing. I think that really ties into this, is really seeing how the team communicates on a daily basis, uncovering those nuances. And that's something that is something you can do that's very useful as a DevOps engineer, is to understand how the team communicates in a very detailed manner, and then try to introduce little improvements to communication incrementally, which really add up over time.
Yeah. One other thing that I've seen that works is, and this is something we're doing at my current job, when we submit a pull request to the application, there is a pull request template that's been added to the repo that GitHub automatically picks up, right? And so we use that, right? And we kind of check off the stuff in the checklist and we make sure that we're communicating all the things that it's asking for. And what I found is that if you can give people, again, you know, going back to that template, back to that process, right? How do we communicate about bugs? This happens when we do this, and this is the setup, right? We go and talk about security in terms of these things, right? And we make sure that we communicate about these kinds of threats and these kind, you know. And so again, if we have a process, if we have a template for not just for how we do things, but how we communicate about things, it gets us a long way down the road.
Yeah. Anything that can, if there's something that's supposed to happen automate or document that it's supposed to happen into the natural workflow rather than relying on people to remember that that has to take place.
Yep. All right. Well, let's go ahead and do some picks. We could keep talking about this all day, I'm sure. But yeah, so picks are the last segment of the show, and it's essentially just a shout out about stuff that we're enjoying.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
Jeffrey, why don't you start us off?
All right. So my pick for this week is a book and a book club. So I picked up, I think it's like second time I've at least gone through the book Project to Product by Mick Kirsten. IT Revolution, who is a publisher, the reason I picked it up again is they did a book club with the author, with Mick Kirsten. So they had like a session today where he was doing some Q&A. And I thought it was really cool. And it actually really ties into what we were just talking about today, because, you know, he's really expanding upon what we were talking about, but really sort of building it out and saying, you know, what's the value stream of everything, you know, every piece of work that we do should tie to a value stream that ties all the way from like business requirements. And, you know, we're talking about companies for making money, so it all comes down to revenue. And when you tie everything that you're doing, every change you make, any piece of code you write, whatever it is, you tie it to a specific business outcome. Now, all of a sudden, you've got the leaders of the company behind it saying, yeah, we're all about making your life more efficient and fixing problems and all that. And so he's, I think, in his work, that's really what they're trying to do, is sort of help companies to map out what do those value streams look like, so that you can really sort of talk about what is flow in the company, where are these, how long does it take to do each piece of work that ties into the flow of the work stream and all that. And now all of a sudden you can start to look at where the bottlenecks are and start to remove them. And I think, you know, we sort of hit on this, like there could be bottlenecks anywhere, you know, siloed companies, non-siloed companies. There's just, you know, so many places. If you can start to map out where those are and get buy-in all the way at the highest levels, that's really what he talks about in his book, Project to Product, is moving from the old project management mindset of reducing costs and being on budget, right? That's what everything is about when you're doing it from a project management standpoint, to thinking about it from a product standpoint. Our goal is to build this product or to enhance it or to whatever it is, fix defects in it or whatever, but it's all about the product. And that is all about optimization. That's all about business outcomes and revenue and all that. And it's not about just cost. I mean, cost could be part of it, but it shouldn't be the whole thing. And delivering something on time that you've never delivered before. Like, how does that ever work? So anyway, that's my pick, is that I think it's really cool when you can read a book like this that really sort of brings some these concepts up to a higher level and get a little bit more out of it from, you know, hearing from the author himself and talking about like what inspired him to write this book from experiences that he had consulting with really big companies like Nokia when the whole Symbian platform just dissolved around them. That was one example he uses, right? But then he gives other examples as well that are really just helpful to sort of bring it to light.
Awesome. Caleb, what are your picks?
Yeah, I just have one for this week. It's a metrics and observability tool called Observe. I think their website is observeinc.com. I'll send it to you as well so you can throw it in the show notes. But what I like about them is they're kind of trying to reimagine metrics and observability. Probably they're most similar to something like Datadog, but at the same time, totally different. Basically, they try to ingest, rather than having like agents listening on different parts of the infrastructure and things like that, and then billing based on how many, you know, servers you're running or containers you're running, they try to just ingest everything, because the theory is that, you know, these days storage is cheap. Storing data, like unstructured log data on S3, is pretty cheap. So if you can just ingest all of it, store it very cheaply, and then they actually bill you based on usage, not on, you know, the size of your infrastructure or the company or the team. It's really on how much compute resources are you using to do queries on this data and to structure it and, you know, those kind of things. And I'm just starting to play with it. I haven't used it a lot yet, but I really liked the sort of innovative thinking around the billing there. I've been burned by metrics providers in the past that, you know, maybe you end up with a bigger bill than you expected, or it just got really expensive over time as your infrastructure grew. So that's, I just wanted to shout them out as a kind of an innovative, interesting metrics tool that I've been playing with recently.
Awesome. That sounds really cool. I'm going to throw in a couple of picks. So I did mention monday.com. We are currently in the process of moving our podcast process, right? Talking about a pipeline, right? We're moving a lot of that over to monday.com. So yeah, it's been really interesting just to kind of see what the limitations and things like that are with a lot of this stuff. And yeah, anyway, it automates so much stuff. It moves a lot of stuff kind of out of your hair, and yeah, automates the processes. So I'm gonna shout out about that. And then I picked up this book, and I haven't started reading it yet, but it's kind of the next chapter in where I'm going with devchat.tv, and it's called Who Not How. And I think this is also very germane to our conversation here. I was introduced to the concept first by Russell Brunson when he was talking about how to get stuff done, and it's who, not how, right? And so a lot of times as developers or DevOps folks, we kind of focus on how do I get this done by myself, right? And that's a lot of times where we get into trouble instead of focusing on who should be doing this, whose job is it, whose responsibility area is this, right? And if it's ours, then let's take it on and make sure that we're not the bottleneck. But if it's not our responsibility, then let's go find the who or hire the who, right? If you're the team lead or the manager, and get that part of things running by the person who really ought to be doing it, you know, whether that's a consultant or whether that's somebody in your organization or whatever. But it's a really empowering concept when you look at it and say, you know what, I don't have to solve all the problems. I can solve some of the problems by finding the right person to solve them. And that's by Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy. Will, what are your picks?
So my pick is this newsletter that I recently stumbled upon, the DevOps Bulletin. It's devopsbulletin.com. And so what they do is they take and just troll through all of the DevOps information that comes out each week and then summarize that in the form of, like, here's their recommended book, here's a recommended podcast, here's a recommended thread on Stack Overflow or something, and just kind of send you the DevOps digest for the week.
Very cool. Yeah, put a link to that in the chat and we'll get it in the show notes.
Okay.
Will, if people want to follow you or see what you're working on or anything like that, most people throw out like Twitter and GitHub, but if there's another place you can throw it out too, where do people find you?
On Twitter, I am WF Button.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah. And then I'm also doing some YouTube work. And if you're interested in seeing the YouTube videos on DevOps for Developers, you can head over to devopsfordevelopers.io and then get over to the YouTube channel from there.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for coming. This was terrific.
Yeah, it was good. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, folks. We're going to go ahead and wrap this up. And we will be back next week. And until next time, Max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.